was a bit of a dark kid. I'd occasionally stage my own death for fun. Mother, I've taken a whole bottle of pills.
Oh, my God. What did you take?
Tums.
Maria, those are your father's.
What, Mother? I can't hear you. The calcium is coursing through my veins.
If laughter makes us feel better, why do so many comedians talk so much about how mentally unhealthy they are, such as Maria Bamford?
I never really thought of myself as depressed as much as paralyzed by hope.
And Marc Maron.
I'm just saying a lot of people are on medicine. They don't need to be because, let's be honest, folks, it isn't easy for anyone. And I think in most cases, the only difference between depression and disappointment is your level of commitment.
And Conan O'Brien.
I used to think I needed to be incredibly unhappy to be funny. And people tell you that's not true. You get to a point where you don't care if it's true or not. You just think, you know what, I'd rather be happy.
I didn't go to a shrink until I was 22. And I started doing comedy in New York when I was 20. So laughter and sadness and depression, they all mixed together for me.
That's Chris Gethard, who is a stand-up comedian and the host on the Fusion television channel of The Chris Gethard Show. And he has his own podcast called Beautiful Anonymous. And on both of those shows and in his stand-up act, he often talks about his real struggles with depression and other mental health issues.
Comedy was really, I think, in many ways, looking back on it, one of the things that was keeping my head above water.
Yeah.
So you don't want to romanticize it because that stops people from getting help. That being said, there are so many notable examples of depressed comics. But I've thought a lot about this, and I kind of think that the skill set of a comedian in many ways might overlap with someone who is really emotional to maybe out of control degree, in the sense that when you think about a good stand-up comic – a good stand-up comic doesn't just have good jokes. They know how to go into a room and say those jokes and sense how the crowd's responding to them and send the crowd in a certain direction for the reaction through like subtle manipulation, through the way they're telling the joke. You know, the very, very best comedians in the world always say, like, if they'll switch an individual word and try that out and play with it like it's a science. It makes sense to me that people who train their instincts to just completely sense how other people are affected by things are people who in their own right might be prone to be highly affected by things.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And you had to deal with thoughts of suicide and harming yourself and all that. Was that happening too while you were like in junior high school and high school, or not until later?
When I was a freshman in high school, I was being bullied pretty bad by this kid named Scott. And our lunch tables were next to each other. And I sat with a bunch of freshman nerds and he sat with a bunch of sophomores. And they would bully us and they'd yell things at us. And then they started throwing food at us. And it was just demoralizing, you know, being there as a kid getting, you know, nailed with food and tell the teachers and they're not doing anything about it because they don't catch them in the act. And then you got clothes covered in this stuff all day and everybody's making fun of you. And it was building. It went on for like months. And there was a...
That's bullying.
It was. And I remember I brought a razor into school and my plan was I was going to cut my wrists in the bathroom. And then in my very melodramatic 14-year-old brain, I was going to write the word Scott on the wall of the stall I was in. And I went into the stall and I started, I don't know if I was seriously going for it, but I started trying to see if I could draw blood. But it was very difficult because the razor that I brought was one of those like single-
Safety razors?
Like a single-use disposable plastic. Like they can barely, you can barely
shave.
Get through a shave without needing to use like four of those, let alone to take yourself out.
So you're in college, you're an adult, you're going to a good university, you're, you know.
I'm reasonable.
Okay.
State University.
But a well-known state university.
Yeah, a well-known, good name brand.
But, they have like, you know, a lot of shrinks in university health service. Why did it take you until 22 to get help?
I remember there were two or three times where people would express concern, whether it was friends or family, and I would tell them, okay, I'm going to go see the shrinks at Rutgers. But I think it is – I just never went. And I think it's such a taboo conversation, especially back then. Like you have to keep in mind this is 1998. I'm at a state school. I come from a blue-collar neighborhood in North Jersey. Irish Catholics who are just legendary for stuffing their feelings right. down. It was just like nobody followed up. Nobody ever checked to see if I was actually doing it.
So once you you become an adult, you become a comedian, did they feel – did your mental – can I call it a mental illness?
Yeah, say it. I'm fine with that.
Did it feel connected to, hey, I'm going to become a comedian?
The mental health issues I had and my comedy pursuits were very tied together. I don't know how much I knew it at the time. I was aware that it was the thing that made me happy most consistently. Very aware of that. But I also look back and realize that it was dangerous because it would be – I wound up – it was sort of this like adrenaline rush that I was chasing. You get on stage. You get that instant feedback. You say a thing. People laugh. And that means they like you.
I met a girl. I thought she was really cool. She was 24 years old. That's how old I was the last time I went on a first date. I asked her out. She said yes. I was excited. She was not as excited. I learned this when she did not attend the date.
I go back and forth because I realize comedy was really saving my life. It was also maybe becoming an addiction to the adrenaline. And the other aspect of it that goes in the negative column is I think it was one of the reasons I resisted actually getting help for so long. Because I think I was really buying into that myth of you have to be tortured, you won't be funny anymore. Like part of what's interesting about me and part of what gives me so much to say and a desire to say it is that I'm driven by these dark times. So I can't get rid of those because that'll affect my comedy. And I look back.
You'll always have those.
I actually shake my head at it so hard because it's one of the things I hear from people the most in my profession about why they don't seek it out. And I go nuts because I actually got funnier. My career didn't really do anything until I was on medication for a few years because it's like, yeah, for as interesting as it might be to be a loose cannon, once I was medicated and once I was in therapy, it was like, oh, now I can organize my thoughts. I can do second drafts. I can take meetings and not be just racked by anxiety and nervousness. Like all these skills you need to be able to have a career are things that only set in once I actually straightened my head out. And it breaks my heart how many people, even today, as someone who talks about this, I will oftentimes have younger comedians approach me, and so often they, I don't want to go on pills. I think they'll take away my edge or something. And it's like, well, good luck with that. I hope it works out. But I think that's a really dangerous myth, and I wish people didn't perpetuate it.
Apart from like letting you get organized and write scripts and return calls and all that, has it affected the jokes you think of?
That's a really great question. It's so hard to say because I don't know what jokes I would be writing if I hadn't been medicated. But one thing I can say is that I was in therapy from 2002 to 2004 and I was medicated. And that was when I look back and really think of my time doing improv at the Upright Citizens Brigade as like its most fertile. And then I went off the medications until 2007 and things really hit the rails again over those years. And then 2007, when I got medicated again, that was when I started doing stand-up and I started telling personal stories on stage.
She said, when you were little and the other kids used to pick on you for having such a big head, it always broke my heart because I knew that when you were being born and you started crowning, like when you were emerging, the doctor took a step back and shouted the words, "My God, his head, it's as big as a bowling ball."
And I think that was the first time I was really on a drug cocktail that was really working for me, that was really designed in a way that worked for me. So I think, I don't know if the content of my jokes would be funnier or more interesting if I wasn't medicated, but I think once I got to a place that chemically was correct for me, is also when I started being myself on stage and talking about my personal life on stage. And, you know, those are things that are very daunting to do and you feel a little judged. And I think it did help me transition to a place where I had the bravery to do that, to go up there and be myself and try to say things that I actually meant.
Yeah. There's an episode of your show, of your TV show, where you had people call in. And you and L.A. Kemper, who's the actress from The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, asked them if they were okay. I want to play a clip from that.
Bethany, who's next?
All right, let's talk to Kyle.
Let's ask
Kyle,
him.
Baby, are you okay?
No, ma'am.
All right, Kyle, what's going on?
I don't have a college degree. I'm 25. I don't have a job. I'm scared I'm going to die alone, and I'm scared to talk to girls.
You have a lot of time to sort things out, figure out what you want from life.
That's great advice. And I'll say from my end, you have a great beard. There's girls who just love a good beard. You got to find the beard girls. Look at the smile on your face,
yeah,
Kyle. How bad
nice.
Can things be?
I guess not very bad.
Oh, no, they still sound so bad. Just based on that reaction. I don't think we're going to solve all your problems.
The idea there being...
Well, basically to provide a platform, what I've come to realize is that I have a platform and I have this material that I do from my own life at times that will go dark and that manages to wind up being all right and wind up being funny. I really remember the feeling of being young and feeling like I wasn't supposed to talk about this and feeling like it was kind of like, well, go, if you're feeling sad, you go deal with it and don't freak everybody out. And I think, you know, for as cheesy as it might be, I think I really sat and thought about like what would have been useful to me when I was 14 or 15 and really scared and feeling really broken and feeling like I wasn't allowed to talk about it. I bet if I had a forum that was outright saying, no, you not only can you talk about it here, but not only will we not judge it, we won't even take it that seriously.
Right.
Like, well,
and
I'll just laugh
about it.
It's
not an educational PSA.
No, we're not
Son,
solving
what's
anybody's
wrong?
Problems. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, it's not, it doesn't have to be this big life moment to just say, hey, I get sad sometimes. And that to me feels like, well, if I can provide that and still make it something that comedically I'm proud of, it would almost be wrong to not try to touch in with the viewers and see how they're doing.
You're a different version of Mr. Rogers or something.
On some level, as sad as that might be, I think there is an apt comparison there.
Chris Gethard, thank you very much.
Thank you. That was a fun talk.
Everyone is laughing, baby.